deeply appreciative of the privilege of serving you and the invitation that has been extended by the local ecclesia here. It's a little bit embarrassing that some of the previous comments that have been made in connection with the acceptance of Ezekiel's temple by those in the by Jewish authorities, because such is not the case. It's merely that three reasonably influential people of diversified backgrounds have manifested such great interest in the literalness of the temple that they'd like to see something done about it and are attempting so to do and to interest others of their race. But its acceptance or not, that remains to be seen. In any event, this temple will not be literally built until after the kingdom is established. But it's a potent weapon for the truth. Brother Russell himself, in 1905, in an article entitled The River of Life, comments upon the literalness of this temple and the surety that it will be built. Our subject matter today has to do with Revelation. We are not accustomed to give talks along this line generally on this book, except locally at the private meetings. But this time we were disposed to felt inclined to so do. My wife would have preferred to have the talk on the jewels, but I think this would be more suitable at this particular time. We read in Revelation, the 17th chapter, the 3rd and 8th verses, the following. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. 8th verse. And the beast that thou sawest was and is not, and yet is. So the substance of our remarks this afternoon will concern the scarlet-colored beast in the book of Revelation. Now, there has been great discussion amongst Bible students of quite diversified background as to what this beast represents. Some have felt it represents the revival of pagan Rome. Some have thought it signifies the rise and development of communism, some of Nazism in the past, and others that it represents the papal Rome. We are inclined to the latter view. Now, I trust that you will be merciful and appreciative of the fact that while we discuss this subject, that there is bound to be differences of opinion on this subject, and we approach it from a standpoint of trepidation, but of conviction, of personal conviction, and we leave the matter in your hands and in your own judgment. And thank God that our basis in the family of God is not based upon our clearness or our unclearness in this subject, clearness of vision. It's based on more substantial truths, closer truths. And thus, this afternoon, for what it's worth, we'd like to discuss this subject with you. In the 8th verse, or 11th verse rather, we read this, that this beast that was and is not, even he is the 8th, and is of the 7, and goeth into perdition. Now we understand that this means that while the beast is said to have only 7 heads, yet strictly, from a numerical standpoint, it has 8. Because of the fact that one of the heads makes a second appearance upon the beast. It is because of this 8th head that it is a duplicate of a previous head, or one, that the angel describes it as one of the 7. Manifestly, then, the 8th is of the 7. The seven are described as heads. Therefore, we think the eighth pictures a head and not a headless beast. We are familiar with the fact that in one place in the volume, in the reprint, in the year 1896, in a sort of a news article, there is a simple comment to the effect that Brother Russell said that the seventh head of the beast was at that time the then-present Victor Emmanuel dynasty, and that he believed that the eighth condition would be a headless beast and a republic. He also made a statement that shows the basis for this conviction, that this has been on his mind, in connection with the, I think it's the third volume. Yes, here's something. He says that in 1870, all the temporal authority of the Pope again ceased. We believe never to be revived. That's on page 58, the third volume. However, brethren, it has been revived. The temporal authority of the popes, the Vatican States, were returned by Benito Mussolini in the period 1927-29. They were restored, and a concordance was entered into between the State of Italy and the Vatican. And others followed suit shortly thereafter, such as Nazi Germany, the concordance, I think it was in 1933 or 31, about that time, and other nations. Now, Brother Russell, in connection with this subject matter, he has confided with different brethren during his lifetime that he was not positive of his understanding of the 17th chapter. To some, he told that he had two diverse viewpoints in connection with the explanation of this chapter, and he wasn't satisfied as to which was correct. But that he tells us in other places, when he would get a clear view of the whole book, then he would write upon this subject for the benefit of the brethren. Now, of course, the first thing when we read about this beast and the woman that's described in the third verse, the question naturally arises, how can the woman and the beast both represent papacy? That's a logical question. And we'll go into this. First, notice in Revelation the 13th chapter, the beast there, that you know, the one that was a leopard beast, that had the head of a lion, the feet of the bear, the body of a leopard, and it came, rose out of the sea, and it did such wonderful things that John was amazed what he saw and how this beast trampled underfoot the people of God. What did the beast represent in the 13th chapter? Papacy, right? That is the general agreement amongst the brethren. I think they will concede that point. What about the 16th chapter, 19th verse, when it tells about that three unclean frog-like spirits came out of the mouth of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet? What did the beast represent in the 16th chapter? Forward to the fourth volume. Papacy. What about the 19th chapter, verses 20-21, when it tells that the false prophet and the beast were both cast alive into the lake of fire and brimstone? What does the beast represent there? Papacy. Brethren, we are impressed with the fact of the uniformity of the symbols, that they are consistent, even in the book of Revelation. When it speaks of the lamb throughout the book of Revelation, it doesn't mean somebody at one time and another person at another time or a class. It represents Jesus, wherever the lamb is found. In one way or another, it describes qualities of our risen Lord and the work that he is at hand doing, and he's described as the Lamb. And it's this basic uniformity and consistency of interpretation of this symbol that we have a reliability that we understand the subject. We feel, too, that the beast, wherever it is found in the book of Revelation, likewise symbolizes the papacy, and not one thing at one time and another at another. Some have trouble in connection with that, and they say, well, here we have an exception to this, that it does not represent papacy, and they go to the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation, and they quote verses 7 through 10, where we read, in connection with the two witnesses and their experience, when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them, and kill them. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of that great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. And they of the people, and kindred, and tongues, and nations, shall see their dead bodies 3 days and a half, and shall not suffer their dead bodies to be put into graves. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them, and make merry, and shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets, they tormented them that dwelt on the earth. I think that'd be sufficient coverage there. Now, we believe that the beast here does not represent France or the people of France. There are several reasons, and we cannot comprehensively go into this chapter, because that in itself would be entail the whole hour just to go by detail. But we would make some pertinent points. We believe the expression that after they finish their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them. But this is not saying that the beast that comes out of the bottomless pit would at this time ascend out when he made war with them. It's an identification mark that you know the beast that's later going to ascend out of the bottomless pit. That beast, like such as the 17th chapter, that beast at this time is going to make war against the two witnesses of God and shall overcome them. We believe the fulfillment of this is at a little earlier date than is generally presumed, even though there is in that chapter a picture of the French Revolution, which we likewise accept. But this particular expression, we find that is a means of marking of who the beast is. Some places it speaks of this beast as having 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast, the leopard beast, or something. In all cases, it's significant when it says the beast. That's the beast you are already familiar with. That beast, papacy. Another thing, it tells us that Jesus was crucified in the street of this city, where we believe Jesus is crucified in Christendom, not in France. The vision also has a wider application in that you note that nations, peoples, tongues are rejoicing over the death of these two witnesses for 3.5 days, and they don't allow these witnesses to have a decent burial. But while the witnesses are dead on the street, they are making a mockery and rejoicing over the experience of these two witnesses, which we believe represent the Old and New Testament. When France proscribed the Bible during the period of the French Revolution, the various other nations were not sympathetic with the humiliation of the Word of God at that time. In fact, the other nations were horrified at what they saw was one of the fruits of this rebellion. And that was what the adversary at first thought, that by their horror and terror and seeing what was happening there, that they would put more stringent bans, restrict liberty even further, and that the adversary would indirectly accomplish his purpose of suppressing the truth. The other nations were startled at the radical feature of the French Revolution, and they did not rejoice. The other nations did not rejoice over the two witnesses being put to death in France at that time. Another thing, it tells that these witnesses were dead 3.5 days. And we find that during the period of the French Revolution, the Bible was prescribed for less than 2 years, not 3.5 years. We believe that days in the book of Revelation refer to years, symbolically speaking. The 1260 days of the wilderness represents 1260 years. And the same here, the 3.5 days represents 3.5 years. And thus we find, we believe, that here are just a few of the factors that would prohibit, we believe, the interpretation that this prescription of the Bible in France by the rebellious element or lawless element of the people of France over the Word of God, where they dethroned reason and humiliated the Bible, that that was the fulfillment of Revelation 11 chapter. We believe it is not, that it was not 3.5 years in duration. Now, can the beast represent papacy? Yes, we believe. But now, does it represent Nazi Germany? Or fascist Italy? Or Russia? Let us consider for a moment. Can it represent Russia? Was Russia not, and then became, it says the beast that was, is not, and is to reappear. Was there a time that Russia was in great prominence and power, and then it was not, and then it's later to reappear? Another thing Brother Russell calls our attention to, that this beast, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns, is Rome in one form or another. That the very fact that the 7 heads identifies it with Rome. And so most Bible students, even in past generations, have just wondered whether it meant Rome pagan or Rome papal, and we think that their reasoning was justified. That it had to be one of those two, and not other nations involved in connection with this particular fulfillment. So Russia is not a part of this beast. And what was, remember the definition given us in the first reprint. I can't take time to give all these pages and give the quotations. I'll have to presume that several of you have read these things, and we're merely trying to relate these various references to one integral whole, and a harmonious whole. You notice the interpretation given in the first reprint, that the 7 heads represent the 7 successive forms of government controlling Rome, and therefore cannot represent Babylon, Media Persia, Greece, and then Rome, and some try to get the 10 heads this way. It represents Rome in one form or another. The next thing, does this beast represent the state? Well, we just said before we didn't think so, because that since that the beast represents papacy in the 13th chapter, the 16th chapter, and the 19th chapter, which is generally accepted, we believe it's logical that it represents the same thing here in the 17th chapter. But now, this question as to whether it could represent the state. Let's go for a moment to the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation. We believe papacy there represents the beast. Most of it. But what do we mean by the beast represents papacy? Do we mean that it represents a religious government in the sense that it's church and state together, that beast there? Evidently, that isn't quite the thought. It's a religious government, but not a religious government in the state of church and state, as we might expect, because why? We find that Brother Russell gives the interpretation that the dragon, wherever it is found in the book of Revelation, represents the purely civil power. I just take for granted you know these statements. What do we find in the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation? That the dragon and the beast coexist. And if the dragon represents the state, how can the beast represent the state? We believe that there is a difference of view here. That the dragon only represents the state, and that the woman in the 17th chapter, when she's pictured as riding the scarlet-colored beast, it does not refer to the civil government of Rome, of which the Church of Rome is controlling. That is not the thought, we believe. She's not seated on the dragon. Now some say, well, look at the color of the beast. It's a scarlet-colored beast. Look at that dragon back there. Wasn't it red? And they make a tie-in that this scarlet-colored beast in the 17th chapter does not represent papacy because it's really the dragon. Only the Lord's pleased to use the symbol of the beast in this particular chapter, which would be an exception to the rule. But we believe this is not the case. The color there in the Greek are two different words. The fiery dragon in the 12th chapter of Revelation, the Greek word used there to describe the color, is not the same Greek word that's used to describe the color of the beast in the 17th chapter. So we cannot use that color as a tie-in to say that the beast the woman is riding is the state. Well, then we might say, well, then what is it? What does it represent? How can the papacy be represented by both the woman and the beast? We believe that the woman represents the Church of Rome from purely an ecclesiastical standpoint. and that the beast represents the Church of Rome from the standpoint of a state, a Vatican state. Now, there was a time in past history when the Church was in the hour of its power. That little Vatican state and the papal state, which was insignificant as far as territorial size is concerned, it wielded a terrific power, and yet there were only a few insignificant states, but the Lord was pleased to recognize it as a beast, as a government. It's a religious government, and this is not the Roman government that's pictured as the Empire of Rome. That's pictured as a separate symbol as the dragon. The dragon represents the Empire of Rome from the pagan standpoint. Notice when the dragon was cast out of heaven by this man-child that grew up. And the dragon, it doesn't speak of it in the book of Revelation that there was a period that the dragon was not, does it? It doesn't say that there was a time that the dragon didn't exist and then he reappears. Doesn't it show in the book of Revelation that the dragon has always existed? And that it went down and persecuted this woman, cast out a flood of waters after it, and was contemplating warfare afterwards. We find it on the scene, and we don't see that expression used with a dragon, but only with a beast. Now let us go to where it tells us that, and the Lord took me in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman seated on the scarlet-colored beast. It is true that in order to appreciate spiritual truths, that we have to have a separated viewpoint. We have to have a consecrated viewpoint, separate from the world and its spirit, in order to see papacy in its real deformity and its blasphemous claims. We have to have that to appreciate how they've been taking to themselves these prerogatives and honors that have been due to only God himself and his beloved Son, our Messiah. But we believe that this separated condition in the wilderness signifies a little more, and that helps us to understand and appreciate the background of this prophecy. The angel, one of the angels, said, in connection with the plague, said to John, I will show thee the judgment of this whore that you saw seated on the waters. I'm paraphrasing it, making it, condensing it. And well, how did he do that? This woman that's seated on the waters. He carried John away in the spirit back to the 1260-year period when the true church was in the wilderness and the Church of Rome was in the heyday of its power. It was not only a separated condition, but John was transferred backwards, as it were, to a point of time in which he was living and seeing this beast during the period in which it was described as was. When he talked to John, this angel, he first showed him this vision of this beast having names full of blasphemy and a woman riding him, and this woman was bedecked with royal robes and filled with the blood guilt of the death of the saints and so forth, and with this wine of fornication that she had, that's pictured earlier in the chapter. Then after this vision is ended, he explains to John the significance of this vision. And he says, you know that beast that you saw when I took you back to the 1260-day period, and you were there and witnessing this beast and the woman, that beast back there was. But now, in the point of the standpoint of the interpretation of this vision, that beast is not. Yet, another power is to appear, and then after that seventh power fades away, then an eighth condition would arise, and that eighth condition would be the revival of papacy. That it would again appear, that the beast that was and now is not will later reappear in somewhat the same form that it did back there in the 1260-day period of its power. Next thing, notice, the beast is described as being full of names of blasphemy. Was pagan Rome really full of names of blasphemy? Was the state full of names of blasphemy, so it's descriptive as full of names of blasphemy? No, we believe not. What about Daniel? What about the 13th chapter of Revelation? Who was it that's described as making blasphemous claims against God's temple and his people and his altar, his church? Who was it pictured? It was pictured papal Rome. In Daniel the 12th chapter, Revelation the 13th chapter. Why do we have to separate it and say, well, this represents the state? It represents papacy and its blasphemous claims at this late date. What about in the second volume? There's a portion of the chapter, Man of Sin, I believe, where Brother Russell goes and shows that blasphemy has a much deeper significance than we might first suppose. It isn't merely cursing God. That is a form of blasphemy, but that isn't a real blasphemy. It's to blaspheme by misrepresentation. The misrepresentation of God's name, his character, his government, his kingdom. That is blasphemy. And to accept the honor, the emoluments of fellow men and appropriate to oneself when these honors belong to God and to Jesus. And by accepting this reverence of the people, when the Apostle Peter said to them, lifted the people up that tried to worship him, and Paul did on another occasion, he says, I'm a man, I have like passions like you, what does this system do? It blandly accepts them, accepts the honors and reverence, and that is entirely unbefitting the Church of God. We should not. That honor is due to Jesus. He is our head, and not no representative of him. We have no vicar or representative of Christ. He is the head. And he doesn't have to be here in the flesh for us to accept that fact. We have acknowledged that headship down through the age of our invisible Lord. One is your master, one your head. Another thing, notice in connection with the papacy in Thessalonians, I forget the first, second chapter, where it tells about this man of sin that would arise. To be falling away in connection with the truth, and this man of sin would arise, and eventually it is shown as going into perdition. What is this beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit? Goes into perdition. So we have several clues, and to me, as I'm just an ordinary Bible student like you folks, and I'm presenting this forcibly with conviction, because it's my own personal opinion that this is, as thus saith the Lord. And I respect you. If you differ with me, I'll still love you as brethren, because I realize that our consecration, acceptance of the Lord, is based, like I said before, on more substantial truth. Consecration, devotion to Jesus, and turning away from sin and recognizing him as our Savior. Those are more substantial as the family of God. And we don't know where we stand until the end of our calling. And brothers, you could have clear understanding of the truth. Maybe a year or a month or a day from now, we don't know. Those things are out of our control entirely. It's our heart and acceptableness to the Lord. Now we find here that in connection with this picture that they go into perdition, both are described. The man of sin goes in perdition, the beast goes in perdition. One has fallen names of blasphemy, and in Daniel it's the horn that has a big mouth speaking blasphemy against God's people. In the 13th chapter, that beast is spoken of as having heads of blasphemy and blasphemous declarations that are being made by that sister. And it does not use that expression in connection with the dragon. Blasphemy. But it does with papacy. So these are just clues. And in the 13th chapter, we're just reviewing, the dragon and the beast coexisted. Therefore, the beast cannot represent church and state, because the dragon represents the state. The beast represents the Church of Rome as a temporal power, as a Vatican state. That is the picture we believe. What about later on, the later chapter, we see the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon, they're both making these messages, and out of their mouth is coming these unclean spirits. There we have the dragon and the beast together. The beast is not the dragon, and the dragon isn't the beast. They're separate symbols with a separate significance. Therefore, we believe that the woman in this picture represents the church as an ecclesiastical or sacerdotal power. Now, Brother Russell did believe the church was coming into power. And what he didn't think was that it would be necessary for the church to have, again, temporal power. But he says, even though this system is outwardly shorn of all temporal dominion, yet secretly it rules the nations of the earth with greater power than the emperors did of old. And he believed as a sacerdotal power, a priestly power, as an ecclesiastical power, not as a Vatican state necessarily, that it could exercise influence such that it would be able to put the Lord's people to death. But we believe that both are true, that it will have that sacerdotal power, and that the church would again receive back its state, which has already occurred during the days of Benito Mussolini. And we're finding now that who is the most prominent authority in Rome. We believe that the papacy is gaining more significance and more attention
than the present Republic of Italy. Even though there are these two powers in Rome, the religious power is getting more recognition by heads of state and are being conferred. And that power is growing slowly, gradually, upwards. But it has not yet reached the peak of its power. We believe that is yet future. We're just picturing these as straws in the wind. Now, another thing, you notice that in connection with the time of this vision, when the angel says to John, now, if you want to see this woman that's seated on the waters, what it represents, I'm going to show it to you now, I'm paraphrasing. And then he takes them back into the wilderness, and he sees the woman seated on what? On a beast. What was he seated at the time before he brought John back to the wilderness? She was not seated on the beast, she was seated on water. At the time of the vision, as it starts in the book of Revelation 17 chapter, the woman is seated on the waters, not on the beast. Because the beast was not. It says the beast was, is not, and yet shall be. So he's describing this vision from the standpoint, is not now, the sixth head of the beast. He says five are fallen, one is, right? Five are fallen, one is. One is yet to come and must continue a short space, and then the beast that was and is not, and is of the seven, even he is the eighth, and so forth, and goes on. So we see that at the time of this vision, the woman is not seated on the beast. John had to be transferred backward into the 1260-year period to see her when she was seated on the beast. Now she's seated on waters. And he says, I'll show you the judgment of this woman. And he did that by transferring or posing John back to the wilderness period of 1260 years. Another thing, in the 13th chapter of Revelation, when it speaks of the beast there, it speaks of one of the heads as having a wound as it were unto death, doesn't it? That is identical with the period when the beast was not. Back in the 13th chapter, that represented the papacy. And it said that deadly wound ultimately was healed. And then another beast, the two horn beasts, counseled others that they should make an image like unto the beast, which had this wound by the sword and yet did live. It speaks of this two horn beast, that's the only time that it shows up with that characteristic phrase, two horn beast. Later on, it's embraced by another symbol. And it's called a two horn beast. It's not called the beast, because the expression the beast is like the lamb. It pictures the same entity wherever it's found, only under different circumstances and conditions. Just like the dragon, wherever it's found, represents purely a civil power. But in some cases, there are modifications of that. But that's the basic thought. And then at the conclusion of the chapter, it says to the effect that this woman that you see on the waters represents that city that's reigning reigneth over the whole earth. And the seating on the waters pictures it as an ecclesiastical power. Let's put it this way. The Church of Rome as an ecclesiastical system has always existed, hasn't it? Was there a period when the Church of Rome was not? That is, from the time it originally was born? No. In fact, that's what has impressed so many worldly people. They say, well, we have seen these atrocities and these contradictions in connection with both the doctrine and the morals in connection with the system, but its very longevity, its very endurance over the centuries is an indication that divine providence has preserved this system. And that's why many have reverenced the system, thinking that only its ministers were corrupt. It isn't the people of this institution that we have anything against. It's the system of doctrine. It's this misrepresentation of the Lord's kingdom and government that we are not in harmony with, because we are so. In fact, in my own case, I was once embraced in that system and reared up, and many of you were. Now, other difficulties seemingly arise. I mean, some find they'll read the diaglot, and then they'll come to the 16th verse, and they'll read in the 16th verse that both the beast and the horn would hate the whore and ultimately make her desolate, would ultimately destroy her. the beast and the horn. And they say, well, that's better than the King James because the diglot is more reasonable and is more literal and more accurate. And we say, generally speaking, that is the case. But that isn't in the 100% cases. There are many places that it can be shown that the King James is really superior to the diglot. But that's not a general rule. Well, fortunately, in this particular case, the internal evidence of this chapter helps us to understand that this could not be the case. And to show that the word "and" would be an improper insertion here, that if we said the beast and the horn hated the Torah, notice the difficulties that would arise if we put that word "and" in and follow through with consistency. In the 16th verse we say, and the 10 horns which thou sawest, and the beast, these, who? These, the 10 horns and the beast, they shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire, for God hath put it into their hearts. Whose hearts? Well, according to the diglot, the beast and the horn have put it into their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom to the beast. How could the beast give his kingdom to the beast? No, it's the King James in this case is more accurate. It's the 10 horns which desolate the beast and hate it and destroy it ultimately, withdraw its support, and not the beast itself. Then we're told in this chapter, of course there are many other reasons, we could go on for hours on the subject actually, and I hope you're sympathetic and appreciative. Even if you disagree, we hope that something good will come out of this by God's grace. That there are many interesting things to be observed here. We're only touching on them. Another thing, it says that God hath put it into their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the word of God shall be fulfilled. Now you'll notice in connection with this beast and its power that it tells us in another place in this chapter that John says that all shall wonder. Here it is, the 8th verse. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. We believe that the revival of papacy in its form in the past, when it manifested such an evil character and trait with the Holy Inquisition, the persecutions of that day done in the name of God and of his people, they think, well, that thing is a thing of the past and will never be revived. That spirit would never appear again. We believe that by the reappearance of this sin and this sin system and the manifestation of these same traits of character will show the people that it has come back into existence again, much to their astonishment and amazement. But it tells us that those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life, they shall not wonder. Now, we believe this embraces all the truly consecrated, even those who might not see these things at this time. Because when such things would come to pass, the very fact of the appearance would say, well, we were wrong. It has come back into power. And they would no longer continue to wonder with great amazement. It would take them just an instant, relatively speaking, to readjust their sight. But the world, not having any understanding, having no preparation whatsoever along these lines, they would continue to wonder with astonishment. And finally, they would rebel in indignation and cast the system down, as it will in the future manifest its true face. And it tells us that God has put it into the heart of the 10 horns of this beast to agree and to fulfill his will and come together. In other words, if these things were left to their natural course, this union would not take place. The knowledge of our day and other factors would make it impossible for this agreement to take place. But God has put it into their hearts, as it was like Pharaoh, by allowing certain ones to come into positions of power and influence, and others who might be a detrimental or hindering factor, they are removed from the scene. And thus, just like he hardens Pharaoh's heart, and we know the understanding of that, I can't go into that now, but in the same manner, by the same principle, this system will get support by unusual circumstances that will arise at this day, so that the people will give it temporary support. And God isn't back of it. By raising different ones, he doesn't coerce the moral agency of the individual. He's not responsible for the guilt. He merely allows the ones to get into power who will do these things. Just like he allows Satan to tempt man. Couldn't he have cut Satan right off right then, nip it in the bud? But he didn't. God was responsible for allowing evil, but he was not responsible for the evil itself. Man, fully enlightened, incurred the just sentence that was inflicted upon him. It was really a simple test in some respects. Now, it tells us that God has done this. It tells us earlier in the 17th chapter that these 10 kings have not ruled as yet. Right? It tells us that the time would come that they would rule, so 1 hour would be. And that is the time in which God has put it into their hearts to agree. These 10 powers, brethren, we believe that the church will be come back into power, not here, America, only, but in Europe as well. We believe that it'll happen in Europe, that the same divisions of power back there, particularly Western Europe, will have again a reappearance. In spite of what current events might reveal, and despite how the straws are blowing, we believe God is going to do this. And it's unnatural, it's supernatural events that will make these things come to pass. But then what happens after a short time has elapsed, this hour, then we find that there is rebellion and rejection and destruction in connection with the powers that formerly supported her. And thus we find that while he's explaining this vision, the woman is on the waters all the time. These 10 kings have not given their kingdom to the beast. That's future, that they would give it to him, and it would be done for 1 hour. Now, this hour, we believe this hour represents the same thing as the hour of temptation. Now, it mentions, you recall Brother Russell's last article where he has that title or caption there, that the hour of temptation, and he shows that after his death, that he intuitively realized that at his departure, that several deacons and elders might be mislead the sheep because of certain symptoms that arose at that day, and that the brethren should be on the lookout. And he gave it that caption about the hour of temptation. So, brethren, with all due respect to Pastor Russell, and we do have respect, we believe it. We believe this hour of temptation is not 70 years long. That it isn't since the harvest. It is not synonymous with the harvest message. That the hour is not since 1874, 78, 81, or 1914. But the hour is a brief period of time. And that's the hour that's yet future in which these 10 kings will get their power to the beast will be the decisive hour. Notice that in this hour of temptation is to try all of them that dwell upon the earth. Right? At that judgment there. And we feel that this has not taken place, that it has tried all. Amongst us, yes, we've had very severe trials. But as we enter that time of trouble, it's going to be a test upon all of God's professed people. Not just us, but all that have taken his name. And we find that there will be the hypocrites will be revealed. The foolish virgins will be revealed at that hour as a class. We believe there's articles on that, two of them in the reprint. And the true saints at their departure will be realized. The bride hath made herself ready, and the other scriptures. Yeah, that's the talk in itself too. God hath put it into their hearts to agree and to fulfill his will, and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God be fulfilled. Now, one other word of caution. I think that the Lord would be pleased with enthusiasm in the investigation of this subject. I don't think he tells us that we're not to be disinterested, that it's unimportant, does he? Daniel was very important to know about visions of God, and he prayed and fasted in connection with an understanding of it. Even though he only was rewarded with a partial understanding, he was sincere. He wanted to know. And so we think it's not improper for us as the Lord's people to really have an earnest, burning desire to know these things. And it would have the Father's approval. But we would mention one word of caution. We have to control our diet. We have to be sound that we do not use undue time on this subject, because there are many other important works in connection with the truth. Some have said the witness work, a work without. There's a work within. And if you study on these subjects all the time, you can see how natural it is. You begin to forget what kind of man or persons we are when we look in the mirror. See? And the other things. So we have to put each thing in its place. And knowing these things in advance, we'll give reasonable attention and study to a sincere, concentrated study of the subject in its place. But there are many other truths, too, that are to be given just as much consideration and importance. So let us not be too enthusiastic, but let us be zealous in knowing these things. And God will guide us, we are sure, that they shall all be taught of God. Without assurance, we need not be fearful or doubt. But the sin of indifference is, and of lukewarmness is despicable in the Lord's sight. When you don't have the interest, it's rather sad. It's kind of nice to be warned for a thing, even if you're misdirected, because you can be changed. You have the desire. You've got the impetus there, but it's misguided. But when it's guided, then all wonderful things. Look at what Paul happened to him. But if you're indifferent, what have you? You've got a limp rag. It can't be moved one way or the other way. It's lukewarm, insipid, cast out. And there's no hope. There's no hope in such cases of really reviving much interest. So we want to pray the Lord for this, that we are more interested and alert. Years ago, Brother Magnuson, in connection with the interpretation of a study, in connection with Gideon and his band of 300, he went into detail in connection with one attribute or aspect or characteristic that was manifested in the one who ultimately God used in connection with the witness effort there. You notice when they came at that final testing point, they drank of the brook and so forth. They scooped up the water with their hand and they lapped the water like a dog. Now, Brother Magnuson had a very long face, and it was very impressive. What he did. And his long tongue, and how that tongue dropped, I can't understand. It seemed to go down 3 or 4 inches, and he would put his head down and put that tongue down and look back and forth. His eyes would roll from one corner. He was imitating the dog while he was explaining this. Well, of course, with a dog, it buries its head down and does that. It buries its head in the dish or wherever the receptacle of water is and looks up. But in this case, they scooped the water up, did not bend and become too deeply investigated, but they were alert for this coming battle. And they licked it from their mouth, but kept their eyes looking to the future as they drank of the water. And brother brought another lesson about giving thanks. Lift it up the head and give thanks, based on another scripture, I think it's in Psalms, if I'm not mistaken. But that thought about lapping the water, that characteristic, that's the one he'll use. And it'll not be in our might or strength or force of character that these things can be done, but merely submissiveness to the Lord. And let us not be surprised at what might or might not be accomplished by those we trust. Let us just make our own consecration real and sure, and pray for one another that we as a body, that we might all see those things in prosperity. The Lord bless and keep you, brethren. Thankful for this privilege.
Some of you try to say that the beast turns on the woman. See, they say that the beast can't represent papacy because the beast turns on the woman herself. And how can papacy turn on itself in that sense? And they'll quote this translation from the Diaglot. But that is not the significance of that verse. When we read it, let's insert this change and see what it sounds like in the 17th chapter. 16th verse. And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate. Now, our brethren would make us change this to this. And the 10 horns which thou sawest and the beast, these shall hate the whore, shall make her desolate and naked, and eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put it into their heart. Whose heart? Well, from their standpoint, it would be the 10 horns and the beast. Put into their heart. To fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom to the beast. The beast gives its kingdom to the beast. You see, by following it in, the very context of the study corrects itself. And we feel the King James is superior to the Diaglot in this verse. And that the spirit of the context of the very verse itself shows that the other couldn't take place. For God hath put it into their hearts, this is only the ten horns it's speaking of, not and the beast, to fulfill his will and to agree and give their king to the beast. The beast doesn't give his king to the beast. It's only speaking of the ten horns. So those who formerly supported her for this 1 hour withdraw their support. Now in the next chapter, it gives us a little explanation about these ten horns, and it likens them to the ten kings. It says in the next chapter, who draw afar off and watch the smoke of her burning, and they say, alas, alas, what great destruction has come upon this city. And they marvel how rich and wealthy she was and powerful of all life. Even the souls of men were committed to her power. And now look, in this brief period of time, all this destruction. And they bewail it because they realize they're next. Now in this chapter, it will be the same powers which formerly supported the papacy, but it will be the upper crust of that, those ten powers. It will be the ruling element of the ten powers who will bewail the mooning of the beast. But the people who supported these powers, well, let's use this principle. The majority of people don't like war. In all the nations, they don't like war, and sometimes in times of peace, they speak very strongly. Well, we'll do this and that, and we think it's senseless and so forth. And, but then what happens when the band plays, and a few people in authority and laws are enacted by a minority of people? It isn't the wish of the majority, war, but a handful of the minority, they feel it's essential, and then under certain conditions of duress, the people fall in line in all the nations, and thus they fight against one another. And against their own inclination. But in this case, it's somewhat the same principle. The ten powers support papacy because they feel, what else can we do? It's the only thing to do, to support religion against communism. But the issue is far deeper than that. It's God's kingdom that has to replace both of these. Communism hasn't its place. It's unsatisfactory. It isn't the panacea that the world's looking for, and neither is the ideal papal faith. They're both are detrimental to the true welfare of the people and can't even begin to give the benefits that Christ's kingdom will give. Life, health, happiness, and no more death. But there, the minority are instrumental. And so back here, the minority of the rulers will be instrumental in getting their nations to support them. The rulers of these nations, the upper element, will be instrumental in getting the people to follow them to support the beast against the common enemy. But later on, the people withdraw their support, and the upper crust element, pictured by the ten kings in the next chapter, which is a little bit different picture but related, they go off and bewail their mourning, where the others are angry. The people underneath them are angry, and then they devour the woman, pictured by the horns. That's the ten horns of thou sawest, these shall hate and make, and it mentions various stages of her destruction. I don't know if I forgot the question now or not, but...
It's like ten horns, the ones that support her, they say when they turn against her.
Yes, the ten horns are. They support her, and then they turn against her. They turn not against her only, but even it results from the destruction of the beast itself.
Yes, Frank?
Yes.
Are the one day of Revelation 18:8 and the 1 hour of Revelation 18:17 the same as this 1 hour of Revelation 17? That's in one day or place.
Well, I believe that there's two different thoughts there, and both relate. In one sense, in connection with her rise to power, that'll only be an hour. She'll be both lifted up and cast down within the space of an hour. In another sense, these events have been transpiring during this, what they call, take in the wilderness. There was a 40-year period in the wilderness, and what did they call that? The day of temptation in the wilderness, when your fathers did provoke me to so-and-so. And that's referred to in some places as a day. We refer to Lincoln's Day, Noah's Day, and so forth, as a contemporaneous period of the time associated either with an individual or a work. We believe the day here is synonymous with the harvest at the end of the age, that this is the day that's referred to in which all the plagues come and her destruction takes place in this period of time. And contrasting this day over the past, it's relatively sudden. But then they repeat it over that in this 1 hour she is destroyed in a most marked fashion. That's brought into the picture. They're two separate things. They're not synonymous, but they're related. It's like you can look back and you can look and review, we relate World War. We see the beginning of all the trouble and we say, well, that's World War I, really.
and then we call World War II, and maybe in World War III. We associate it back there. But the actual destruction will take place within the hour, when she's both lifted up and cast down in that hour. Another thing, take with the plague. It'd be a strange thing to exhort the Lord's people to get out of battle unless they receive their plague. And here we say the harvest has been going grandly on, and the great bulk of the harvest has taken place, hasn't it? I mean, you look back at the First World War, and shortly prior to that, there were hundreds who symbolized their consecration, not at national conventions, but in regular conventions, localized, like Boston, different towns like that, and in England, hundreds. Here, in a national convention, we might have 6 or 12 for the whole year, as far as that group is concerned, in this way. It doesn't seem, it's a drop in the bucket. The reason the fruitage today, with all the effort, the results are much poorer. So we could say the bulk of the harvest is in the past. We're not saying the harvest is over. The harvest will not be over until everyone last one's in. Now, wouldn't it be strange for the Lord to come out of battle and let you get these plagues? If the plagues were all to be in the future, that's rather strange advice, because they're not even in danger of getting those plagues, because they're all future, and the great majority of them are going to die. Don't you see how it doesn't make sense? Those plagues have been happening right along, and they've been happening in synonymous with the harvest message. And that's why we believe that the volumes do represent the plague, and have been trying to so teach for so many years, and that they have been happening, and they have had an effect on the hearts and consciences of God's people. And we don't have to see that work. It's taking place in them. They know. When it comes to death's bed, a lot of them know. Even the great company class and individuals down through the age, you don't see and say, well, he's a great company. There's no way of knowing that. But those of that class know. It says, those that have a conscience void of offense to God and men. That's what proper office we should have. And to have some sort of assurance. We might have periods of great depression, but we should have moments of assurance, too. Mixed experiences. And to us, it would not seem to be logical to say that here the Lord tells you to come out of battle unless you're going to get these plagues, and yet we believe that, well, maybe a tiny little handful of the Lord's people are going to live at the time those plagues occur, and because they're faithful, that tiny little handful is going to escape. What about the great folks that have been in this harvest message when this message has been pronounced? Come out of her, let's see. You see, I don't even get the gist of my reasoning, but to me it seems very logical that these plagues have been happening. And that the dramatic one will be the last one. But that's the one that we're looking for big things and striking events that will take place. Just like the walls of Jericho fell when they circled the city the seventh day, 7 times. As after that, then the city did fall down. But all the other was the preparation work and was related thereto and has a part in that picture. Can we sit down yet? Thank you, Brother Frank. I guess there are probably some that still have some questions on the 17th chapter of Revelation. In fact, if there's anybody that doesn't have any questions, maybe he's ready to write the 7th point. Who'd like to do the hymn for us to close?